Good afternoon. I'd like to call the first meeting of the House Finance Committee of the 28th legislature in order. 29. That's what I thought. Today is Thursday, January 22nd, 2015. The time is 1:32. We are meeting in House Finance Committee Room 519, and we will be starting on time. Some of our rules here. First, I'd like to do a roll call, introduce my co-chair, Representative Steve Thompson from Fairbanks, and our vice chair, Dan Sadler from Eagle River, also one of our new committee members. We also have three additional new committee members, Representative Gaddis, Pruitt, and Kawasaki, returning back is Representative Wilson and Guerra, myself, Representative Newman, Representative Munoz, and Edgman. And Representative Guttenberg. I'm expecting them soon, I hope. So we do have a quorum. Also like to introduce our staff, our Legislative Finance Committee Room staff. Helen Phillips is the House Finance Committee Assistant. Helen? Helen's going to introduce some of her staff.
Hi, I'm Helen Phillips, and welcome new members, and welcome returning members back. I'm the House Finance Committee Assistant, part of Legislative Finance Division, and the other members of the staff. We have two secretaries. We have Bree Wiley, and I think she's behind the computer there, and we have Jody McDonald, and we have Dave Thomas, and he'll be the page clerk this year. Blue left us and is off doing marine biology. We'll miss her. There's a few little housekeeping reminders. So we're nonpartisan staff, and we work at the direction of both co-chairs to provide clerical and secretarial support for both House and Senate.
A little closer?
Okay. Senate Finance Committees. We're part of Legislative Finance Division. And it's our staff hours, of course, are always as needed, but in general, they're staggered to assure committee coverage between 8 and 6, and one person will be available on Saturdays from approximately 9:30 to 1. And during meetings, the page or another support staff will be sitting over there to pass notes or otherwise assist members, just flag them down. Supplies, each member, as you know, has a little box at your spot. And there's also, for new members, behind you are two drawers with your name on it. And the top drawer is for bills and that are in committee. And then in the bottom are the reported out drawers. Let's see. Well, just I'm sure you're all familiar with your mics. And just as a reminder that when you are having private discussions, to push the little button so it won't get picked up and recorded. There's also reference materials in the room. We have three sets of statutes that we tried to locate for easy access behind the co-chairs and one over here on a shelf. I think it's just being covered by the screen, and then another set behind you over there. We have admin codes, and so hopefully, and then when we do receive detailed books, they'll also be available on the shelves over there. And then the bill files are made up for each member once a bill is scheduled in committee. And prior to the meeting, they are filed in your top drawer, and then when they're reported out, they're in your bottom drawer. The weekly schedule is distributed to your office via email. The use of the House Finance Committee Room is coordinated through Representative Newman's office. And for new member staff, if you need to get a note to your representative during the meeting, you can hand that to Dave, and he'll be happy to deliver that. So I look forward to working with you this session. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Helen. There is a, you'll notice, a committee introductions housekeeping business packet in your on your desk. So you got the different logistics concerning that. And while we're at that, there's also another packet on committee rules that go over the committee rules on quorums and stuff. You'll find that information. This is basic same information that we've had for years for the members that have been here. We did add one new one, Representative Thompson and I, for the use of electronic devices at the table. We did not want to allow electronic devices at the table here while we're have meetings are going on. That's the only new one. The rest are the same rules. I am going to be handling the operating, supplemental budgets, and special hearings. Representative Thompson will handle the capital budget, committee legislation, and special hearings. Staff that I have on ledge finance, most of you know Pete Eklund and Joan Brown, will be doing the ledge finance work here. Representative Thompson, Leon, introduce your staff.
Yes, my chief of staff, Jane Pearson, and handling the capital budget for me is my staff, Joe Michelle.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Some dates to keep in mind. Governor's supplemental budget is due February 3. Governor's operating budget amendments due by February 18. And we'll be meeting every day next week, doing agency overviews and into the following week. So I believe there's a schedule out or will be out soon on all the budget finance subcommittee meetings. We do intend to have the subcommittee closeouts. February 27 is our target date on that. We'll be finalizing that schedule as we move along, but that's our goal right now. And subcommittees going to be starting as soon as possible as next week. So we're going to hit the ground early and do what we can. As we get, we do have a commitment from the governor as he's got updates on right now they're working off of what they call a draft operating budget in action. And as they get updates, we will get them from either OMB or the departments. And so we do have a commitment from the governor and OMB to do that for us. So that will help us along. Any other questions from the committee before we start? Thank you. I would like to recognize Representative Kawasaki's joined us. Today we have a presentation on Alaska's fiscal status by David Teal, Legislative Fiscal Analysis, Legislative Finance Division. David, if you can come forward and introduce your staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am David Teal, Legislative Fiscal Analyst, and I'm just going to have my staff introduce themselves, if that's okay.
Thank you. David, I guess we can start right into the overview of Alaska's fiscal situation. David Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see all the faces, both returning and new. I don't think I'm going to be telling you anything new today. It's much of what I have to say is in the introduction to the overview, which should have been delivered to all of your offices. But I don't think it's any surprise that low oil prices have caused low revenue and corresponding deficits. So I think today is mostly to put some of the information that's in the introduction on the record. So I will just start with slide one here.
And members, we're trying to wrap up by 3:30 today, so you're all cognizant of the time schedule we're on. Go ahead and ask questions of Mr. Teal as we go along. Primarily, if we can keep them right on the slides that we're on. If we get through that presentation, we can open it up to expand the discussion a little bit more on the future. But if we can kind of focus on this, just raise your hands. We'll recognize you. Thank you, David.
Okay. One thing I probably should say before we get too far into the slides, caused a little confusion in the Senate finance this morning, because when I say I'm returning from slide two back to slide one, and then went forward in the presentation, the audience should know that I really do mean looping back to slide one, and they're going to or to figure one, and they're going to have to go backwards in the presentation while I go forwards. But I don't think it's all that complicated, but, you know. So the handouts don't necessarily follow the order of the slides on the screen. Figure one is something you've seen before. Probably all of you have seen before. It's been around long enough that we've referred to it as a 25-year history, and it now has 40 years of history, so we got to stop calling it that and just call it the budget history. It contains pretty much everything you might want to know about Alaska's revenue and expenditures. Of course, it only looks backwards, and it's busy, very busy, and that makes it hard perhaps to grasp what the graph has to say. So a lot of this presentation is going to be to break down the pieces of this slide so that it makes it easier to understand and hopefully easier to look for solutions in those pieces. The first component is revenue. Revenue, as you can see, is volatile, and that's because price is volatile. Production is fairly constant, constantly declining, but it's fairly predictable and nowhere near as volatile as price and revenue themselves are. So the real issue with volatility is that it's hard to have a stable budget with a volatile revenue stream, and I'm sure you're all aware that revenue is our primary source, and that may be understating it. It's 90% or so of our revenue stream. We rely pretty much on that single source of revenue, and because it's volatile, it makes it difficult to stabilize the budget. So the way you stabilize the budget is to build reserves when revenue is relatively high so that you can fill in the troughs. And returning to figure one, you can see that we've done a fairly good job of that. Strange mouse. It's on my screen, but it is not there. And then it disappears.
There it is.
Yes, but now it disappeared from my screen, so it I'll just try that. You can see we've done a pretty good job of saving when revenue is high. Saving would be indicated by the red bars at the top of all the savings, or the top of spending. And the spending, of course, is agency operating budget is the dark blue. Then we have the statewide operating costs, capital, and above that is savings. So when we had revenue, we did save a substantial amount of reserves. Now, this is the same slide as revenue, except I've added price to it. I think that makes it a little easier to see what's happened, or why revenue is so volatile. You can see here that the declining trend in revenue from 82, which was the peak of production, about 2 million barrels per day, declining steadily from there to where we are now at about 500,000 barrels per day. Price had something to do with the decline in this period. So did production. And that is not showing there. Okay, this period from 82 is a pretty constant decline in both production and in price. So revenue declined. Price alone drove the increase during this period to about 2006 when PPT was implemented. At that point, you get a little confused between the impact of price production and the tax mechanism. I'd just as soon stay away from the mechanisms and their impacts and just stick to revenue. We did have high prices and very high revenue in 2008. The prices continued to go up. Revenue followed it. And now, of course, prices fell to what they predict is an average of $76 this year, $66 next year. The dotted line here is just to distinguish between the past and the future so that you can see the revenue forecast over here is exactly that forecast, not looking backward. And the price is the forecast upon which that revenue stream is based. You may question the forecast given this price because you may know that the current price is about $50. And that what we're looking at here in terms of the future is not merely a healthy rebound in prices. Prices are going where they've never been before. This mouse, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's just really awkward. I don't think there's anything I can do about it, but it disappears, I apologize. But the... I don't, but... So you may question the forecast. It's currently about $50, but don't be misled by the spot price. The average price to date in 15 is still $85. So if it remains where it is, we truly will end the year with an average price somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 or so. Again, you may question the forecast out into the future. If you don't believe the price forecast, then the revenue forecast is going to be overly optimistic. We don't do our own forecast. We rely on the Department of Revenue for that. And thank you. So again, returning to Figure 1, the takeaways from this chart really are that without expenditure reductions, or revenue enhancements, you can look forward to roughly $1 billion deficit annually. And that's with the price recovery incorporated in that DOR forecast. That means that the growth that started here in about 2005 and, you know, accompanied by that massive increase in revenue is not sustainable. Expenditures went from roughly $3 billion here to roughly $6 billion here, 10 years later. And many around the capital have known for years that the expenditure growth is not sustainable. Probably even the levels of expenditure are not sustainable. That's not a political conclusion. It's just math. If we were to maintain the growth from 6 to 15, you can see that we would be up. Well, you can't see that because it doesn't show. We would be up here somewhere at about $10 billion in revenue in expenditures if we maintained that trend. And, of course, that's about twice the amount of revenue that we have. So recognizing that situation wasn't enough to avoid it. The predicament that we're in right now is that even though we reduced expenditures after 2013, we're still looking at deficits of $3.5 billion in 2015 and in 16. On the positive side, we built huge reserves during these periods of high prices. And unfortunately, we're burning through them very rapidly. As you, the red bars below the axis are withdrawals from savings, red bars above the axis are deposits to savings. The next three slides break this expenditure chart into pieces, hopefully making it easier to understand the problem and therefore potential solutions. The first of those is figure three, which shows agency operations. That can be thought of as the cost of running programs. It includes formula programs, K-12 and Medicaid, as well as some others. And it includes non-formula programs, which is the day-to-day operations. The takeaways from this chart are that spending was pretty flat for 20 years, all the way from the mid-80s until 2005. But since revenue started to climb dramatically in 2005, operating expenditures have gone up with it. In fact, they've nearly doubled since 2004, very much like the trend that occurred back here when revenue first started flowing. We doubled from $1 billion budget to a $2 billion budget in a very short period of time.
David, when we're looking at this chart, and we look at, say, 83, 85 in there, what is it? I don't know if you have the information or not, but Alaska's population has grown since then, and so the demands on our constitutionally mandated programs, public safety, education, those types of programs have increased. And the legislature responded, I think, in 07 when we had the money to do that, to try and catch up to some of those programs and demands, you know, from the public that we work for to try and bridge that. Do you know what the population growth is in there? Or do you have, I don't remember if any members even think that.
There's a later chart that shows population, so yeah, I will get.
And just while we've got a break here, I would like to also recognize former Representative Mary Kapsner is in the audience here. She used to sit right over there, I think, where Representative Gare is at, if I remember, when I was sitting over there. So a few of us had worked with her. Welcome, Representative. Representative Gare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on your question. But just for starters, David, so I understand 1983, let's say 1984 to 2003, it's about the same amount of expenditures, roughly. That's in actual dollars, right? I mean, inflation, so, or is it in real dollars, of inflation-adjusted real dollars?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, those are nominal dollars.
Actual
dollars.
Through the chair. So in essence, I mean, if you were to take into inflation, spending, especially spending per resident, was going down during that time, and which leads to Representative Newman's point, which is there was some catch-up being played to deal with that when we finally had money. But you don't have to answer the second part, but per person, the amount of spending was going down, and especially in inflation-adjusted dollars. Fair enough?
Through the chair, that's true, and you'll see that in the same slide that population is adjusted on. So,
Representative Pruitt, do you have a question?
No, Mr. Chair, I was actually going to ask the first part of Representative Garrett's question there. So, thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Chu.
So many people think that the driver in this increase has been formula programs. That's not true. They are drivers, but no more drivers than the rest. In other words, non-formula spending has grown at almost exactly the same pace as formula spending has grown. Now, there's some more detail about that operating spending, the drivers that push spending high. The increase from 2006 to 2015 was about $1.9 billion. And this slide just breaks that down into pieces. K-12, which is about a $1.3 billion program now, accounts for $485 million of the $1.9 billion growth, or 26% of that growth. Now, the growth rate of education was about 57% over that period, and that's slower growth than non-formula programs, which grew at about it's slower than Medicaid and far it's slower than normal or across the board growth. It's far slower than Medicaid growth. You can see that if you consider that in 2006, K-12 took up 33% of the budget and now takes up about 30%. So it's a declining share. K-12 is a driver because it's huge, not because it's growing quickly. Medicaid accounts for $415 million of the 1.9, so that together these two formula programs, K-12 and Medicaid, account for almost half of the growth in the operating budget. It's 22% of the pie and 26% of the pie. The share of the budget in Medicaid, however, has grown from 11% in 06 to 15, so it's growing faster than average, in fact quite a bit faster, 149% over that period. So although it's a little less contribution to the 1.9, it is large and growing quickly, and when you have that combination, a big program growing fast, you have a cost driver. The third of the drivers is salary and benefits, $350 million of the 1.9. And I'm going to break that into three pieces as well. The first is negotiated salaries. That accounts for about $150 million. It would be double that if you talked about all funds, but we're talking general funds only here. The monthly health insurance costs used to be about $800 a person in FY06. They're now over $1,300. So health costs have gone up almost $6,500 per employee per year. We've also increased the number of employees by 2,000 during this period. So that with that combination of things, the health care and health insurance premiums have increased by about $75 million during the time. And, of course, benefits also include retirement costs. And here we're not talking about state assistance to retirement. We're talking about the retirement costs that the state pays in every payroll check. It's the fact that the contribution rate has grown from about 11 to 22% where it's capped. And that amounts to about $130 million over this period. So those are your three drivers, K-12, Medicaid, and salaries. They account for roughly two-thirds of the UGF growth that's occurred since 2006. The other one-third is everything from VPSOs, Village Public Safety Officers, to prisons, to the governor's office, to the legislature, to oil and gas permit expenditures. It is everything that's non-formula and that agencies do.
Representative Guerra.
Sorry. Maybe I'm missing something, but David, let's just take K-12. So for that 10-year period, expenditures rose 26%. That's obviously not 26% a year. It's 2.6% a year, correct, on average?
Well, you can't quite do the math that way, but But yes, I get your point. It's, I mean, it's 2% a year wouldn't get you this kind of growth. 2% over 10 years would only be, you know, something like 20% or whatever. But go ahead. Sorry.
And I know we don't have time to editorialize, but I'll keep this really short. But in that K-12 increase, there was a year where we corrected what some people thought was a very discriminatory education funding mechanism and have started spending a lot more money on rural schools to correct that. That was part of that. And that was also a catch-up because the prior 15 years were relatively flat education funding. I don't think I'm saying anything controversial. No. Well, debatable, maybe controversial.
I don't think there's any debate about it. I think it's correct, Mr. Chairman, and I think that what it really gets to is turning back to Figure 3. There's a critical question that you might want to ask here, and that's, given these recent trends in expenditures here and the concern about that upward trend, you might ask, how did we stay flat for 20 years? How is that even possible to have a flat budget given what's happened in recent years? Well, again, I think you can look at the drivers and get some answers there. K-12 was pretty flat during those 20 years. It started out at less than $500 million in 84, and it was still less than $700 million all the way out to 04. So, again, we just talked about education growing at 57%. That was in a 10-year period. This was roughly 50% over a 20-year period. So, flat K-12 questions?
Representative Wilson?
Well, mine's a little more general, Mr. Chair. Thank you. With that growth, though, is there any way to look at the federal government and the requirements that they have, you know, consistently added into different programs, whether we're talking about DEC, DOT, any of those? How much of a driver that possibly could have been in the last 10 years?
Through the chair, it's a good point. There are federal mandates. Many people refer to them as unfunded federal mandates. Federal funding has, or federal mandates have driven state spending more in the future than they did in the past. And that does answer this question, well, why did we grow here? And we'll get a little bit more into that question later. Right now, I was looking at how can you stay flat, which is kind of the other side of the coin. But we talked about K-12. Medicaid doubled during the 90s. That may seem like a lot, but we were at $136 million. We went from $64 million to $136 million at the turn of the century. Medicaid's now at $700 million. So, you know, you're talking much more than doubling in the last 10 years, where the rate of increase has just accelerated so fast on health care costs. Salaries was that the third driver, and there were no negotiated pay increases for most state bargaining units in 11 of the 20 years prior to FY06. So again, you don't have pay increases, you don't spend the money. There were no retirement cost increases. It was 11% for years and years and years, roughly, the normal cost only, because we had no unfunded liability ever until 2005. And then, of course, I touching on what Representative Guerra was saying, this period was a time of slow, if any, growth, could have been negative because of the inflation and population changes. So I think that you wouldn't get much argument about there being unmet needs building up during this time and having this period having the revenue to address some of those unmet needs. Turning to statewide operations, which the definition of that is that they're operating costs, but they're not attributable to any single agency. Things like debt service, which was essentially the entire amount of statewide operating costs in these years. We issue general obligation bonds. The debt service is part of the operating budget, and those bonds were issued on a schedule that would have followed what they called the Prudhoe Bay curve, paid off by 2000, and in fact, that's what happened. And while statewide costs included almost only debt service, it was small, you might even say insignificant during this period. And even as we began growing, it's because we issued general obligation bonds and debt service began growing again. You can turn to slide 6, where there's a breakdown of those statewide operating costs. The bottom bar on this is debt service. We now spend $230 million of general funds on debt service. It was zero in 2000, and roughly $100,000 here in 2006. So it's doubled. But doubling is slow when compared to things like state assistance to retirement. I think most of you know that retirement costs skyrocketed when we lost a lot of money in the stock market in the early 2000s and again in 2008 and 2009, created a great deal of unfunded liability, would have driven rates up to places that municipalities simply couldn't have afforded. Those rates were capped at 22%, and the state picked up everything above 22%. We also do the same thing with teachers, but at different rates. The bottom line there being that it was $18 million back in 2006. At the time that the agreement was made to offer state assistance to retirement, we expected the cost to go to about $75 million in about this time period, and to decline from that point. That didn't happen. They continued to climb, reaching a peak of $634 million a year in 2014. And in 2015 would have been more than that, over 700, or if you follow the recommendations of the retirement board, it would have been over $1 billion. It doesn't show on the chart because no general funds were used here. Instead, they used money from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, deposited $3 billion last year, including the $750 to a billion that would have been a required contribution, and added $2.3 billion or so to pay down some of that debt. Without that deposit, we'd have been marching steadily upward to a roughly $1.2 billion a year in retirement assistance costs.
So, Dave?
Yeah.
Where do we expect that? If we were to extend that line out, where would we expect that to go to?
Well,
there was a plan put in place with that legislation to talk about that. Can you cover that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Had you not passed HB 385 last year, this trend would have continued upward to about $1.2 billion was the projection. With the deposit, it's declined to $260 million in FY16. So put another way, if you hadn't adopted HB 385 last year, the FY16 deficit would be $750 million to $1 billion higher. And instead of a $3.6 billion deficit, you'd be facing a deficit of $4.3 billion or higher. So there's a tremendous payoff from putting that
extra money into the retirement systems, you're saving $750 million or more annually for a deposit of about $2.3 billion. So terrific returns on that money. The next category here is fund capitalizations. Again, they were zero in 2006 and 7, even into 8. It wasn't until 2008, 9 that tax credits became this mouse disappears, I'm sorry, but trying to show you the fund caps, they grew tremendously. Oil and gas tax credits reached $625 million in FY15, and they're projected to be about $700 million in FY16. And again, that's growing from nothing in these early years. The last category of spending is capital. No need to say much about it. It follows revenue curve pretty well. When you have money, there tends to be larger capital budgets. When you don't have money, capital budgets are small. Same thing here. You get the revenue disappears, so does the capital budget. So by this point, you're probably thinking, well, what about the future? Why all this focus on the past? I'm focusing on the past partly because looking at growth and where it occurred might help you unwind some of that growth, and partly because some people blame the legislature for the fiscal situation. And this is where we get to the real cost per capita, because let's look at the drivers again. Negotiated salaries, $150 million. The legislature doesn't negotiate salaries, but you pay for them. The health care cost, $75 million, plus the Medicaid growth of $415 million. This is not unique to Alaska. Every state struggles with health care costs and trying to figure out how to deal with the increasing costs of Medicaid. Retirement costs, $130 million a year built into the payroll, plus the $260 million in state assistance. Again, the legislature doesn't control the stock market, and that's what we're paying for here, is $400 million a year to make up for stock market losses. K-12, $485 million increases. Many would say that wasn't enough. So you look at the total of the things I just mentioned, it's over $1.5 billion.
Representative Munoz, did you have a question?
I did have a question on the credits, but I can, if there's another time or now, either way.
We're okay. Go ahead.
You wanna go? On the tax credits slide, let's see, it's the breakdown. It's another slide. Does the FY16 tax credit, the $700 million, does that reflect any tax credits that were paid off under ACES?
Through the chair, it may. We don't get enough detail from the Department of Revenue to know whether these are carry-forward credits or where they're going. I can tell you that the amount that we're paying in tax credits, and here for those that don't know, and many don't, there are two different kinds of tax credits, and I should explain that. There are credits that large producers can take, same types of credits, but they have revenue, and they simply deduct it from the revenue you owe, just the way we do with our personal income tax when we pay the feds. You have tax credits or deductions, and you simply reduce it from the check that you send to the IRS. That's not what we're talking about here. There's a second type of credit that are the purchasable credits, and that's for small producers or others who do not have the revenue stream to take a tax credit. They're issued a certificate of credit, which they then sell or can sell to someone else, usually a major producer, who then turns it into the state. The state buys it. So they're very different. The large producer credits reduce revenue. The small purchasable credits don't reduce revenue. It takes an appropriation to buy those credits. And that's the appropriation that's climbed to $700 million. You might be interested to note that in 15 and in 16, both, the amount of credits that we're purchasing exceeds the production tax revenue that we're getting by roughly $100 million in 15 and projected to be about $300 more in 16. So now you reach the question of, are those credits on an annual basis? I don't know. I can only assume that if the state's going to issue someone a credit for whatever, $50 million, you can turn it in now, or you can turn it in next year or the year after that. But it's a credit. There's no way to earn interest on it. There's no way that it's worth anything until it's turned in and purchased. Why would someone hang on to a tax credit any longer than necessary? Because you could turn it in and invest that money. But again, we don't get enough detail from revenue to know precisely who those credits are issued to, what they're for, even where they're for. Many of the credits are Cook Inlet credits, not North Slope credits. So those are questions that you might want to have the Department of Revenue come in and address.
And Representative Munoz, we will, in the overview meetings next week, have Revenue and DNR here to talk specifically about them. And if we need to, we're prepared to go further in-depth meetings on tax credits, because it's been such an interest to the public. So we've had that discussion with them today already, with those departments. So we will be hearing more about that next week. So if you've got any specific questions on that, just get them to the chair. We can make sure the departments are ready for them, or else, like I said, they'll be here for the overviews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I particularly remember that there was I believe it was $350 million or so in credits that were paid off under ACEs when we moved to SB 21, and it would be helpful to know where they're reflected or where we can expect them to be reflected in FY 16 or in future years.
Thank you, and I think we've had that discussion with Revenue, so they'll be here to talk. We can ask that question then.
Mr. Chairman, it might also be useful for the members to know that the projection for future credits is not continuation of $700 million per year. The Revenue Sources book shows that dropping to $250 million a year after 17. So they're high, but again, I don't know exactly why. The point was really that if you turn to Figure 8, which is addressing the issue that Representative Guerra brought up, which is, yes, but during this period, population has grown and there's been inflation. What if you adjusted for those things? What does spending look like? And you can see that now we have a clear downtrend all the way from here to here. And if you want to turn it around this way, what we're spending today in real per capita expenditures is less than we spent in the 80s. It's more than we spent in the 90s. But this, remember, includes that $1.5 billion that we just went through. The retirement costs, the salary increases, those things that didn't occur during this period. And if you subtracted the $1.5 billion from here, this downtrend would have continued.
And I think there's something to note here. If you look at the dark blue or dark purple line on the bottom, agency operations, obviously that includes more state personnel costs in there, state employees. And in earlier discussions that we've had, public says we have a lot of public employees. If we were to eliminate all state employees today, it would affect our budget deficit by $1.4 billion. So when you look at agency operations in here, I thought this was fairly interesting because we've become fairly efficient on state agency operations, if you look at that, the actual cost for that. And it's been on a decline. If you go back into 83, 84, 85, in the mid-80s, we were up $9,200 per person. You know, we're at $7,200. The population has grown considerably, the state personnel. So there's been a downward trend in tightening the belt on agency operations in the last 10 years. Representative Guerra.
Thanks, yeah. Question in a second, but I remember the chart last year or the year before, and if you looked at the bulk of the Medicaid expenditure increases, it wasn't that we were just tossing out money. It was people were moving up here, and there were more people on Medicaid, and wasn't anything we could do about that. David, you've explained this to me like three times, and it falls out of my head each time. Can you explain to me what those net fund transfers are, especially that one big year in 2008?
Through the chair, these net fund transfers simply mean that here's your spending, operating, agency operations, statewide, and capital.
Savings.
That is all we spend. There's your revenue, way up here. So the difference between the revenue and the expenditures, the red line is a net fund transfer, deposit to savings, whatever you want to call it, addition to reserve. You know, they all work, but that's what they are. You can see that when we spend more than we have, that net transfer goes negative. These are the $3.5 billion deficits. So that $1.5 billion in hard to avoid costs, if you want to call them that, are half of the $3 billion increase that's occurred since 2005. The capital budget, if you're looking at that as another potential reduction, you might say, well, some might even question the capital spending that occurred and say it may have been wasteful. But there's a point that you should take note of, and that's that about $4 billion of the $10 billion in general funds that were spent on the capital budget during this 10-year period, $10 billion appropriated, roughly $4 billion remains. It hasn't hit the street yet. So as these projects roll out, they will supplement the smaller capital budgets that you might expect because of the lower revenue that's available. So having a very low capital budget right now is not going to immediately stop the capital spending. There's a $4 billion backlog sitting there, if you want to think of it in those terms. So the critical question here, to me, is not who's to blame for these high expenditures. It's what, if anything, can or should you do about the fiscal gap. The expenditures occurred. There wasn't much you could do about many of them. And now, is it possible to cut your way out of the situation? If you believe that oil prices are going to stay low, then you have to do something, and you have to do it quick. This graph shows oil at $60. It's a no-growth scenario in expenditures, capital statewide, everything remains constant. And you can see that the fiscal gap remains at $3.5 billion a year. What that means to reserves is not that we have 4 years left. This graph starts in 14. We're here in FY16. So reserves vanish rapidly at $60 oil. When reserves are gone, you have no choice but to balance the budget. There will be no savings to withdraw from. You either fall off a cliff if you don't address the deficit now, or you begin building a ramp now so that the cliff isn't quite so steep or so deep, long, high, whatever. If you believe that oil is going to rebound, like, and this is the same graph, only now we've changed the model so that it goes back to the Department of Revenue forecast, you can see that reserves last substantially longer out into the early 20s, but you really haven't solved the problem. There's still $1 billion a year deficit. So the question then turns to cuts. Can we cut our way out of this situation? How much do you have to cut? And where can the cuts be taken? If you're thinking capital, the capital budget's about as lean as it's ever been. The governor submitted a $106 million capital budget. Almost everything in that is leveraged money, federal match, other things that he simply doesn't have much of anything in that capital budget that people would consider cuttable without losing money in addition to the general funds. So for other items, figure 11 shows what I just titled hard to cut items in the operating budget. You can go through them. Debt service, as I mentioned earlier, is about $230 million a year. Retirement assistance. The sum of these is $3.2 billion. And that's just these few big items. And recall that revenue is $2.2 billion. What that means is that you would have to cut $1 billion from these hard-to-cut items and eliminate everything else. And these, there's no payroll associated with this. This is debt service, retirement assistance. There are payments to businesses. There are grants to individuals. There are payments to bondholders and trust accounts. If you cut these, you'd also have to cut all state employees funded with general funds. And you, in addition to cutting the billion from here, so that's why I say mathematically, you cannot cut your way out of this deficit. Now, that doesn't mean that no reductions are possible. And it doesn't mean no reduction should be attempted. It simply means that balancing the budget is not as easy as some people think it is. So what legislative finance has done over the years, starting back as far as 2008, we began preparing for the day that expenditures would be more critically examined than they were during the last 10 years. And we've worked with the legislature on several fronts. The legislature has taken the lead on several items. These are the fund reclassification project that we did in 2008, the look-back graphs, the 10-year look-backs that your subcommittees all see, the modeling efforts that we do, like you saw the oil price forecast and the reserve burn and that sort of thing. More recently, indirect expenditure report, their HB 30, now has audits of agencies trying to look for places to cut. And we've considered breaking the capital budget down into pieces that make that something more than one huge number. In other words, showing you very clearly that these projects require federal match. These are job producers. These are various categories. These are grants to municipalities, grants to nonprofits. So that you, instead of having one big capital number, you can see pieces and maybe able to focus on reductions there. So all of these work in combination. The reclass and the redesign of the fiscal summary give you consistent data so that you know where you are. I am almost embarrassed to admit, but I think there was a time when legislators and others could not understand the spending. The reclassification of money was totally confused. You didn't know what was general fund spending. you didn't know what was receipts. And I think that's straightened out, and you can pretty much rely on the fiscal summary to help you determine what kind of money it is that you're spending and how much you're spending. The model can be of great assistance to you in developing a plan, not just a one-year response to a sudden decline in oil, but a logical, defensible, long-term spending plan that's reasonable and achievable that you can use to then set annual targets for reductions in the operating budget. The target there, or the goal, would be to set some level of reserves and determine up front, for instance, that you want to maintain reserves at, say, $6 billion out by 22. If that's your goal, then you work backwards and you say, what cuts do I need to make? What revenue enhancements do I need to make to get that level of reserves? To me, the unfortunate truth here is that balancing the budget on the expenditure side would mean cutting $3.6 billion from the governor's budget. And it would be an understatement to say that cuts of that magnitude would be difficult. I think they're unachievable. As you said, Mr. Chairman, even if you cut every employee's general fund, it would cut $1.3 billion from the budget. So just to put that $3.6 billion in perspective, you'd have to lay off every generally funded state employee and still save another $2 billion. So I think that puts revenue enhancements on the table for discussion. You can hope for oil prices to recover, but Figure 2A showed you that the price forecast that gives you that DOR forecast, which gives you billion-dollar deficits, is pretty optimistic. You saw here that even with the forecast, you can expect deficits of $1 billion or more. And that's without expenditure reductions or revenue enhancements. So the problem here is that the longer these large deficits persist, the lower your reserve balances get, the more drastic the changes you need to maintain a stable budget, whatever that stable level of budget is. So I didn't plan to discuss any revenue options today. I don't have any new options. The usual suspects are income tax, sales tax, property tax. You've got oil taxes or oil credits that you could address, permanent fund dividend, caps, reductions, triggers, a number of options there. There are financial strategies like collateralization or borrowing. There are smaller steps, health care provider taxes, motor fuel taxes. There's no shortage of options on the revenue side. In fact, there may be too many for you to deal with in a very meaningful way. But the governor has stated that he doesn't intend to consider the revenue enhancement measures until expenditures have been reduced. And I know many legislators agree with him. I understand that sentiment because I think that many Alaskans believe that the legislature has spent way more than it should have. I would argue that much of that spending was unavoidable. You have not overspent. That, in fact, the problem here is on the revenue side. It's too sensitive to prices. We see that. And that if you wait to address revenue enhancements, you try to do it sequentially. Expenditures first, a couple years of that, and now we can turn to revenue enhancements, that if oil prices remain at current levels, your reserves will be gone before you can turn your attention from those expenditure reductions and focus on revenue enhancements. And it's too late then. That's an opinion, of course, and I hope I'm wrong. But as I said this morning, in this kind of environment, you hope for the best, but you have to plan for the worst. So that wraps it up from my perspective. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
You know, and it's interesting to note, we, Representative Thompson and I, and talked about this and tried to analyze, if we've got a $3.5 billion deficit, what time frame realistically at best could you address this? And realize next year there may be other, who knows what the deficit or we may have. So if you take that $3.5 billion and maybe at best circumstances in 5 years, I think, reduce that. That's 20% per year, which leaves $750 million in reductions this year. Are we going to be able to do $750 million reductions in just operating expenditures alone? And I don't think we can. So as Mr. Teal pointed out, and through discussions with the department, we also have your basic agency reductions. You've got efficiencies. We all will continue to look for more efficiencies as we work through with our individual departments that we work on through our budget overviews. New revenues, or as Mr. Teal puts it, revenue enhancements. Could be everything from park fees to license to a multitude of things, as you mentioned. Also, we also have new revenue, hopefully, from expanded economic opportunities. We have continued in the past recently, in particular, to try and look forward to the day where we have more revenue coming from royalties and corporate tax, production taxes, and those types of things through legislation and economic development expansions in our communities to try and deal with that. Economic opportunities and expanded opportunities there. So we've asked the departments to come back and also help us in developing a 3 to 5 year vision for their individual respective departments. Through the departments, we obviously expect their expertise to be able to assist us in this as citizens, legislators. So that will be our goal to do that. They are committed to continue to work with us to do that. We're going to work through that through the budget finance subcommittees as we move along. We'll continue to take any and all advice that we can get to try and get to where we need to be. But I think we all understand the situation very well of what we're facing. I feel that we've got a pretty good committee here to be able to deal with the issues, at least for the next couple of years. I look around and I see a lot of areas of the state represented with a lot of different factions, rural Alaska, southeast, south central, northern areas of the state. So I think that we could represent the state pretty good that way with the issues facing our state regionally. So I look forward to working with the members here. But we certainly have our work cut out. We do not have a choice. We cannot spend money we do not have. And there's going to be the difficult choices ahead of us. We will do our best to lay them out and make the decisions as we have to make. We had Representative Thompson and Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Earlier this week, each one of your offices was delivered a indirect spending report that resulted from House Bill 306 last year. It went through revenue and into Treasury, and they did an in-depth report on all of our tax credits and our reduced fees. And they have recommendations in there also that this has outlived its usefulness. It hasn't met legislative intent, when the bill was passed, how much it costs us per year. And some of those they definitely feel like should stay in place. But there is something that we all have to look at. Every legislator needs to look at that. There's millions of dollars there from reduced fees, from tax credits, from fish tax to education tax credits to small business tax credits, all kinds of things like that, and then all kinds of reduced fees also. So everybody needs to take a real hard look at those. Small increments add up to big increments, so. Make sure that you study that, have your staff go over it and see if there's some things in there that you feel we need to address also. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teal, so, you know, if we were a private business, we wouldn't wait to look at the reductions. We would have to because we would have nowhere else to get the money. Would there not be benefits to look at the current budget that we have, because a budget is really a maximum amount that we've given to agencies to spend, not money that they have to spend. So what kind of benefits would there be to looking at what we already passed last year so that maybe some of the cuts coming up wouldn't be as major?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Right now, we're halfway through the fiscal year. That makes it difficult for the agencies to respond by the end of the fiscal year to achieve any real savings. But if your point is, as you do the 16 budget and you see that some programs are going to be cut in 16, some positions will be eliminated in 16, then why not address those same positions, those same programs in the 15 supplemental process and reduce them now? And you could certainly do that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I know we need to make a plan, and there's no way getting there all in one big chunk. But using the two examples you gave, one gave us the 3 to 5 years, but the other example of if oil prices don't go up, we don't have even reserves to get us to year three. Is there a compromise? I mean, should we be looking more at the worst-case scenario, knowing that if oil prices go up, we're okay, versus if we extend out our plan too long, there just won't be savings to use?
Through the chair, that's something that you have to balance. I can't tell you what to do here. I don't have a vote. I can only say here are some charts that hopefully make you weigh that choice. You can wait to consider revenue enhancements. But if you want to address these things sequentially and say, well, we're going to take 2 years to do and look at expenditure reductions, knowing that you cannot reduce the budget enough to fill the gap, then you've wasted 2 years, in my opinion, because it takes a long time in many cases to implement something. Like if you wanted to talk about an income tax, it doesn't just happen. I don't think it's possible to start with an income tax and implement it for January of 15. Now, you might have to wait until January of 17 before you can actually tax. Well, that puts any revenue from that income tax off until all of 17 and then into April of 18 before you start receiving money. So there's a huge delay here from taking action and seeing the results of that action.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And I think it is the intent of these co-chairs to look towards the conservative side of the price of oil. I think that's prudent. If the price of oil goes above that, we got plenty of savings that we need to replenish back as it goes. But I think staying on the prudent side, it would be prudent to stay on the conservative side of that. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, I looked from your first big 25-year, 40-year chart. You showed sometimes in the past when there has been less revenue forecast to be available and the state has dealt with it somehow. I want to give you the opportunity to put some historical perspective on what has happened in the past when the state has faced those conditions and how things are different today.
Through the chair, The Constitutional Budget Reserve was created in 1981. I think it was a great deal of wisdom and foresight there, that that is what allowed these years of spending more money than we had, is that you built up reserves when you could, you spent those reserves when revenue declined. If you're stuck following that revenue curve, then what do you do here? You immediately cut $3.6 billion. Now, let's say that you lay off a bunch of people, you shut down programs, and then next year revenue bounces back. And you say, great, we can re-implement all these things. We'll just hire those people back. We'll just start the whole program up again. It's not that easy to shut down and start up programs. Government is a very slow to respond beast. And, you know, you hire these people back for a year, and the next year there's no revenue again. So I don't think that you can function in an efficient or effective way if you're having to respond to revenue. It's one thing in a state that has many sources of revenue. But when we rely on oil revenue to the extent we do, and the price is as volatile as it is, causing the volatility in the revenue, you simply aren't able to respond. My colleagues look at Alaska and say, you're just crazy. How can you even budget with revenue that's that volatile? And the answer is very simple: reserves. And does that answer your question?
It does, thank you. A brief follow-up, though. Not asking for your opinion, but is there any objective measure for how large a prudent reserve we should keep in that in the CBR or any reserve fund?
Through the chair, what I would say is that there is no rule on this. We're in territory that no other state reaches. You know, they have a recession that drops their revenue by 5% or 10% or something. It throws the entire state government into chaos. They have furloughs. They do the unthinkable: reduce K-12 funding. They have no options. They must respond immediately to that decline in revenue because we can't deficit spend. You can only spend reserves. The prudent level of reserves is dependent upon the volatility. If you have a very steady source of revenue, you can function with a small reserve. When you have a very volatile revenue stream, your reserves need to be high. Clearly, our reserves were very high. We have had, not have anymore, but at one time we had approximately half of all the reserve balances of all the states were held here. NCSL removed us from the reserve charts because we distorted the numbers so much. And other states might say, you can't even do that. You know, Minnesota, for instance, says, if you have a surplus, you have to mail a check back to refund income taxes to people, because a surplus is not what state government is all about. You should balance your budget, and that's it. Well, we had those massive reserves. They weren't big enough, apparently. And, you know, who foresaw this? I can tell you that Ledge Finance didn't. We prepare a budget every year. You prepare a budget every year based on the needs of Alaskans. Revenue is secondary. You can see that because you didn't spend everything in those years. You spent more than you had in some years. because the object is to meet the needs, not to spend the revenue. So based on that, if you want to continue to meet those needs, big reserves. I don't know how big.
Your indulgence, more questions?
President Sadler.
Thank you. My third and last question. I want to give you the opportunity to speak to the accuracy or to the methodologies used by the Department of Revenue's forecast. There have been some changes. I want to try and get those in the record. That do you think it's better, more accurate, more useful, more reliable?
Why don't you try and limit that? We'll have revenue here, too, yeah. In DNR. There was a change in that done last year to make sure that they would become more accurate. But if you have something just brief to add to that.
Just brief. My answer to the last question started you respond to the revenue forecast. Not really, but you consider it. Well, now you have to consider it a lot. People say, well, why do you budget with such a large forecast, an optimistic forecast? We don't. You budget by needs. But we do sort of create this band and say, what would happen if revenue doesn't come in? Here you'll see on page 12 of the overview, there are some sensitivity charts. We prepare those because they tell you, what if oil doesn't come in at the projected price? This is the impact on the surplus or deficit. Last year, our charts went all the way, for FY15, our charts went all the way down to $90. So we didn't see it. I wouldn't expect revenue to see it. I would say that there's not a forecaster in the world that foresaw this. So you can't expect a forecast to be anything better than an educated guess.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick on the hard to cut items, you have three of them have end dates to them. Even though they might be decades out, they have end dates to them. One that we just kind of touched on, and I'm curious if you might be able to give me an idea, is the debt service. Do you know how much debt is out there and the term that we're talking about in there, kind of trying to get an idea of what to expect in terms of a potential end date on that one? I have an idea with retirement assistance. We'll ask Department of Revenue on production tax credits. Just curious if that might be something I can ask you or need to wait for revenue.
Through the chair, I can give you an approximation just based on looking at when the debt was issued, and it is most all of it is after 2005. We have 2010, 2013, 2015 issues. Most of those issues are for 20 years. So the debt service will decline over time, but we're still looking at debt service out to, I'd say that, 2030 or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the retirement assistance, if I remember right, we infused it with $3 billion last year, and it was projected that we'd be paying in the assistance then $400 million a year, and we're showing $260 million for 2016 budgeting. Is that because the retirement fund made 18% this last year? It could go back to the $400 million?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that... I guess you are the chair. I don't know how this works. Good point. With retirement assistance, we never know where it's going. HB 385 did more than simply deposit money. It got rid of some time lags. It changed the method of amortization, some other things. So big impact. We projected it was about 350. And as you say, there were good returns. The methodology used to be that we were always 3 years behind on the rate determination, and in addition, there was 5-year smoothing. So there was a lot of of attempts in the formula to make retirement contributions steady. That makes sense when you're dealing with employers who have to pay something and you don't want your rates going up and down. The determination here was that municipalities pay 22%. It's rock steady and will be for years. The state itself doesn't really care about that volatility, so let's get rid of all these stabilizers in the system so that we respond more quickly to earnings. And those earnings last year were very nice returns, and we were fortunate to see a reduction here from $350 million anticipated to $260. But your point is a good one. If we have some poor returns, that creates additional or new debt, and that new debt must be paid off. But the formula is going to pay it off over a 25-year period. So, if you lose $1 billion, it's going to have an effect, but it's not massive. I wouldn't expect this to jump around by, $100 million. I think that what you'll see is a slow increase in that $260 million rather than a slow decline in that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if we can, I think we'll call that a wrap for the day here. Tomorrow's agenda is Pat Pitney, Director of OMB, is going to give us an overview of the governor's budget request. Obviously, tonight we'll hear some more updates from the governor on his state of the budget address. So thank you all for your attendance in our first meeting.